Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
The My Baby and Me podcast, in association with Nook.
Hi, this is Jane Garvey, and welcome to the My Baby and Me podcast. This is the podcast that's by mums for mums. We're not perfect. We've got so much wrong in the past, but we want to share with you some advice, some stories, and maybe just something that will gee you up and make you realise you're not alone if you're concerned about being pregnant, staying pregnant, or in this episode, getting pregnant. We're discussing fertility and staying healthy during your pregnancy and beyond. With me in the studio, the writer and broadcaster Lucy Mangan. She writes pieces for The Guardian and for the magazine Stylist. Good to see you, Lucy.
Hi, Jane.
Also here, Colin Davis, Mr. Colin Davis, consultant obstetrician and gynaecologist at Barts Hospital in London and an expert in fertility, Colin.
Good afternoon, Jane.
And finally, the comedian and mum of two, Lucy Porter, children of four and nearly three.
Nearly three, and I'm an expert in nothing.
Well, yeah.
And everything at the same time.
Okay. You're my kind of contributor. That's absolutely brilliant. Now, how old were you both Lucy's, when you first became a mum? Lucy Mangan.
A couple of months short of 37.
Okay. Very and Lucy start. Porter.
I am trying to work it out. I was 36, 37 when I gave birth.
And I was a mere, it feels like a mere 34 when I had my first.
But now, spring chicken.
But look at me now, I'm utterly spent. Colin, we're all quite old, actually, to have had a baby in our 30s. Certainly wouldn't have happened a generation or two ago.
I think that's a fair reflection of society now, that women are starting or have been starting a little bit older to have children. And sometimes that's why we find there can be more difficulties in getting pregnant. But generally speaking, a lot of women who do try in their 30s do get pregnant relatively easily.
I think the most common age of first-time birth now in England and Wales isn't officially for the first time over 30, isn't it?
That's correct.
Yeah. Yes. But, of course, women's lives and ambitions and expectations have changed in a huge way, but not their bodies,
yes.
Not actually the basic biology. So what do you do?
That's a tricky question. I think the important thing is, of course, women often try to have a baby when they're in the right relationship. And I think part of the challenges are really being in that right relationship at the age that one wants to be. So there's the competing interest of work, and there's also finding the right person to have a child with.
Is that why, Lucy's, you got pregnant relatively late or decided to get pregnant relatively late? Lucy Mangan?
Yes.
And Lucy Porter?
It was all about finding the foolish man who would take me on.
Yeah, and that therein lies the problem, Colin, because
yes.
Women probably would consider having a baby earlier in life if they were with the right man. Sometimes even the right man doesn't want children at the right time for the woman, which is very, very complicated.
It's a very common point that often there is a lot of conflict in the relationship when a woman sort of in her late 20s, early 30s thinks now's the right time to have a child, particularly when they want two or three children. And leaving it another 4 or 5 years creates a degree of anxiety, and I think that puts a lot of pressure on the relationship.
So men have a part to play here. I mean, we don't want to blame men, but it isn't all about women, because largely most women want to have a baby with a man.
I think that's correct. And I think having support and discussion about the whole process of having a child, what's involved, is really important. I also think from a male point of view that men feel responsible and they feel like they've got to provide. And I think one of the messages that I often hear is that actually men don't feel ready because they don't feel able to be able to pay for the cost of a child. And it is expensive to provide the level of support that's needed. But I think you never really know till you actually start and try.
I mean, but does male fertility decline? I mean,
The point is that the commonest reason for infertility is male factor.
Yeah.
And so whereas about 20 years ago, it used to be other conditions like fallopian tube disease, problems with ovulation. Nowadays, the number one in most of the fertility units, certainly in the UK, is male factor.
And so why is that changing?
Well, we don't know, but we think that lifestyle, diet, nutrition has a big impact to play.
But presumably that's not so much age-related as it is with women then. Their sperm's buggered from quite early on by lifestyle, is it?
Over time,
to put it very technically,
well,
Colin, I hope you can follow me.
I follow very clearly, but I think that's true because, of course, as we all know, that the time scale for a woman to have a child, it's very much dependent on when the menopause is going to occur, which on average is between 50 and 51. So the real fertile years are between 20 and 40, optimally in sort of the mid-20s up to mid-30s. For men, they can still have children at a much older age. Although sperm quality does decline over time, it doesn't inhibit them from having children.
So you do often hear and read this sort of stuff, you know, your fertility falls off a cliff when you're 35. Is that the case? I mean, have you got absolutely a snowball's chance in a frying pan of conceiving naturally in your 30s? Clearly not, because all three of us around the table did.
Yeah, and I think that's absolutely right. In my experience, where I see a lot of women in their late 30s, early 40s, they can still have children. I think that the most important thing is to look at the situation, decide what may be stopping them from getting pregnant. Try and adopt a more holistic approach, which is look at the man, the woman. Are they having intercourse at the right time? Is she ovulating? Are the sperm normal? So basic investigations are really important as a starting point. And then guiding them about what they need to do to give themselves the best chance of getting pregnant.
Do you come across couples who genuinely don't know, actually, when the best time to have sex is, if you just want to get pregnant, if that is your number one goal in life?
Yes, I think that's the number one point, is actually to know, is a woman ovulating? What's the fertile? What are the signs of actually that they're fertile? And a little bit of discussion on that point really helps a great deal. And some women will go away and then a couple of months later they'll be pregnant. I think...
How can you tell if you're ovulating?
Well, there are a number of signs. First of all, finding out, is the menstrual cycle regular? So are they having a regular monthly period? So let's say a woman has a period every 28 days. It's very likely that she's going to be releasing an egg about 14 days before that period starts.
Yeah.
There are ways of actually assessing that. A simple thing would be looking at cervical mucus or vaginal discharge. Stringy, watery mucus discharge, some women describe a sort of sensitivity, mid-cycle pain. Mm-hmm. We call that Mittelschmerz. It's a German term for middle pain.
There's always a German term for it.
Yes.
If it's miserable and mucusy, got a word for it.
Fair comment. But it's another sign that perhaps ovulation is taking place. And they're also urinary tests as well. So as we have the pregnancy test, which is weighing on a stick, you can weigh on a stick to see whether you're actually releasing an egg and show where the fertile time is.
So long before you need to worry about going to see somebody about your fertility, if you simply, you're young, relatively young, you're deliriously in love, you want to have a family, just have lots of sex around the middle of your cycle if you're having a regular cycle.
I think that's a very fair comment.
And if you have too much sex, the quality of sperm doesn't diminish.
That's a very good question as well. It doesn't really, because there have been fertility treatments we've done where we've done sperm analysis, we've done insemination, where we take a sperm sample and tested it 2-3 days running, and we find that the sperm doesn't deplete very much at all. The ideal situation is to have intercourse on a 24-hour basis, so daily, rather than have 3 or 4 acts of intercourse in one session, is to have intercourse 3 or 4 days running. Now, one of the problems is actually...
Which is more realistic. I mean, maybe I've just been unfortunate in life, but I think that may be more realistic.
It is more realistic. But actually, one of the challenges is men find it very difficult to perform on demand. Mm. So very often I'll say to my female partners, I'll say, you know something, don't tell the man that you're fertile, just have sex normally. Because otherwise, if you say that now's the night, men sometimes can't get an erection.
Well, it's actually quite, it's not surprising, is it?
Yeah.
I mean, anxiety, they can't put the bins out on demand.
Another chore.
One more chore. Well, actually, that was something I was going to ask, because sometimes getting pregnant, particularly if you're really feeling some sort of pressure to get pregnant, it does become a chore when it is meant, it used to be just 6 months ago.
True.
Something you got quite a lot of pleasure out of without really thinking about
it. Exactly, and that's puts a lot of pressure on the relationship in those situations.
And it changes, the whole business of sex changes.
Correct.
So you're not a sex therapist, but have you got any tips on how we can ensure that it continues to be fun?
Well, I think first of all, taking the pressure off it and reassuring couples that they don't have to have sex 4 or 5 times in a day. I think once every day, every couple of days around the fertile time is the minimum requirement. And that's often enough.
OK, let's say then things haven't gone as well as people might have hoped, and IVF is a possibility. There's also ICSI or so, ICSI.
So ICSI is a treatment whereby one sperm is injected directly into the egg, but a woman would have had to go through the IVF process of having drugs to stimulate the ovaries to have those eggs collected, and then the sperm is directly injected into an egg to create the embryos. So it's an offshoot of IVF.
It's more targeted. It's isn't
that? Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. I mean, but you'd only do that if IVF hasn't worked for you. Or?
Well, a lot depends on the reasons for not getting pregnant. So if the sperm count's very, very low, and the sperm function's very, very poor, then the only way of realistically getting pregnant with that sperm level would be to do the ICSI process of injecting one sperm into the egg.
And IVF, put very simply, is what exactly?
So IVF is a method by which a woman receives hormonal injections for about a couple of weeks. At the end of that time, she undergoes a procedure under light anaesthetic to collect the eggs from the ovaries. Those eggs are then, one egg's put into each dish. So let's say a woman gets 10 eggs collected. We have 10 dishes. The sperm are then produced, washed down the laboratories, and then about a million sperm put into each dish to allow the sperm to fertilise with the egg. And over a course of up to 5 days, we monitor the result of that fertilisation and choose the best embryo or embryos to put back inside the uterine lining.
And you said earlier that actually most infertility is caused by the male half of the partnership. What, if anything, can be done to improve the quality of the sperm?
And certainly there are a number of things that can have an impact on sperm function. So lifestyle is very important. So a sedentary lifestyle, poor diet, for example, a high carbohydrate diet, low protein diet, so a fatty-based diet is not healthy. Cycling a lot as well. So people who do excessive cycling can put pressure on the testes. And then there are the things that we all know, which is excess cigarette smoking, drugs and alcohol. And very much alcohol is a big issue because in society, people do drink a lot, often to cope with the stresses of work. And reducing alcohol can be a very important factor in improving sperm function. And then in terms of vitamins, for men, vitamin C and zinc and magnesium are very helpful in terms of improving sperm function.
So a man who'd like to become pregnant with his partner...
Impregnate,
that's it, thank you. There's no reason why they can't take zinc in the same way as the woman might be taking folic acid.
Absolutely, 100%. And that's certainly a very sensible thing to do, to take supportive vitamins that can make a difference, as well as looking at lifestyle changes.
So you could have sex once a day as you remember to take your vitamins.
There we are.
You could do that. That's
you could write a note on your hand.
Yeah, have sex, take this.
Or his penis, yes. That'd be amazing. Oh, must take my pills.
But it is interesting that, that infertility is often, I know that you'd know this isn't the case, but regarded as a woman's issue and a woman's problem.
Absolutely.
And clearly, it's just not where we're at now, is it?
And that's really important because when we're seeing couples in a environment to discuss fertility issues, it's really important that both are there, male and female partner, because there are things that can be done to guide and help couples. Because if a woman just comes alone, that also sends a signal that she's on her own, that she's not being supported. And it's not as much a priority to the man as it is to the woman. And I think it needs to be shared, the responsibility. And certainly I believe in treating the couple, not just the individual.
What about the cost involved? And also the success rate is about, what, 25%?
No, I mean, it depends on the individual circumstances. I'm always asked, what's the success rate?
I'm
and
sure,
people have these league tables. And I always say the success is very much dependent on the causes of infertility and the ability to achieve results in terms of the treatment given. So, of course, a woman who's 42, 43 having IVF treatment will have between a 10 and 15% chance of success at most. Whereas a young woman who's 28 years of age, who has unfortunately got fallopian tube disease, will have something like a 65 to 70% chance of success with one cycle of IVF treatment.
But I suppose most people coming for IVF, I'm guessing, are actually in their 40s.
Yes.
And that's just a fact, isn't it?
Although in the NHS, certainly where I work, we treat women up till the age of 40 who are funded on the NHS. And so we will see a younger group of women, sort of mean age of about 32 to 34 years of age. So we do have a slightly skewed population. Because it's funded on the NHS, it means that people do tend to come a lot earlier. But certainly outside of the NHS, a lot of couples are a lot older because they are not funded for treatment as well.
And how much would it cost them?
So one cycle of IVF could be as much as £6,000. And the reason there's a variation in the cost, it depends on the cost of the medication, the amount of drugs that they need to achieve the egg collection that's required.
It's all a long way from, we were just talking about, yeah, you know, in an ideal world, you'd have sex as often as you can around the midpoint of your cycle. It might be become a bit of a chore, but basically you probably have a laugh while you're doing it. Mm. This all sounds hard work, actually, particularly for the woman. But I know you understand that, don't you? And again, there's no guarantee of a baby at the end of it.
I think it's a process. My view is that any couple wants to feel that they've done everything in life to achieve their goals, and someone needs to listen to that. They need to listen, support, understand, and take them through that journey. And one of the challenges, really, to give that individualised care as a couple, rather than feel part of a treatment, rather than actually looking at their needs individually. And part of looking at their needs is to give them counselling and support. And certainly in the fertility world, the role of the fertility counsellor is very, very important. And the regulatory body, the Human Fertilisation Embryology Authority, or HFEA for short, places great emphasis on the counselling process. So I think fertility is very well served in terms of giving support to couples. And again, we do emphasise that greatly, because we can't do everything by just doing an IVF treatment. If it fails, it's devastating. Mm. We need to give them the backup, really, the support that they need, because it can affect their relationship terribly.
At Nook, we believe our job is to make your life easier. For over 60 years, we've been listening to midwives, doctors, dentists, and most importantly, parents. Only by listening have we been able to deliver a range of products that is specifically designed to satisfy the needs of mother and baby in those precious early years. To find out more about the full range of Nook products, visit our website at www.nook.co.uk. Nook. Understanding life.
Lucy Mangan, you did have a few problems conceiving, is that correct?
Yeah, I had a useless cycle and periods not worth talking about, and I kept track of my temperature, and I couldn't tell that I didn't think I was ovulating. So, which in a way was quite good, because it meant we didn't try for ages and ages. We tried for about a year with nothing happening, and I thought, no, there is something up, so... I went on Clomid and Metformin, and had a little operation to remove some of the bigger cysts on my ovaries. And I was very lucky, because shortly after that we did get pregnant.
I had friends who said that the drugs kind of had mood effects on them. Did you find anything like that?
I think it was just very lucky. It all went quite smoothly once we just admitted that... you know, something was up.
Mm-hmm. I'm not underestimating that, but that was as much as you had to do. You took Clomid, yeah. And it basically the problem was sorted.
Yes.
How long do you think, how much further do you think you would have pursued? I mean, if things hadn't happened and you hadn't had your son, what do you think you'd have done?
Well, I don't know, because we're both sort of natural pessimists, we were already sort of thinking about adoption and thinking, you know, if the worst came to the worst, if we just couldn't have a baby. And we were quite... Yeah, we were quite okay with that idea. I mean, it would have been, you know, much more difficult, obviously, in reality, and we would have had to, you know, grieve for what you don't get.
Mm. You wouldn't have ruled out IVF, or you didn't consider it?
I think we probably would have tried that, but it didn't seem much less appealing than adoption, which I think for a lot of people, adoption is then another thing you have to get your head around. Whereas,
yes. Yeah.
I mean, my half-sister's adopted, and I think we were just that much... more
tuned into it. Yeah. Go on, sorry, Lucy.
I mean, I think when you are a bit older, when you start trying to conceive, you have been through
exactly,
all
you've
those, you've had those conversations,
it, yeah.
Haven't you? So, I because we had been not really using contraception for a couple of years, I went to the doctors and started they started examining my fertility, but then I was lucky enough to get pregnant. So, you know, in the end it wasn't needed. But, yeah, we'd certainly talked about how far would we go and would we try and you know, we hadn't really come to any conclusions though.
People do make judgments though, don't they, Colin? And I must admit, having had children, and it is the greatest thrill of my life to have had children, I would absolutely, and I feel very privileged. But people do make judgments about people who pursue IVF as though there's something slightly unhinged about them. And in fact, they're only doing what the rest of us have, by pure fluke, been able to do so-called naturally. And you're probably very protective of the people you see about fertility.
Yeah, we are very protective because we feel for them, really do, because it's a very common problem. About one in six couples suffer from difficulties in getting pregnant. And I think society doesn't completely understand the effects of infertility. We fought very hard. I've been working in fertility since 1992. And we fought very, very hard, having worked with Professor Lord Winston at the Hammersmith I knew the effects of fertility on couples. And the reason for saying that is because at that time, and not an, it was only the last 5-10 years that actually it's been funded on the NHS. Prior to that, fertility was considered, was not considered an illness. It was considered a choice. And society has changed. So now IVF is very commonly used, very commonly funded on the NHS, and it makes a world of difference. And I think nowadays, when you read about people having got pregnant in their 40s and they mention IVF, it seems to be acceptable, whereas yeah. in the past it wasn't.
Well, it should be acceptable, just as everything else
Absolutely.
Should be. Yes. And let's say then you do get pregnant. It doesn't really matter how you do, but you are pregnant. You have, I suppose you have a particular responsibility at this time in your life to take care of yourself. Mm. And, I mean, every woman is different. And if you've not been especially fitness conscious before, should you suddenly buy a pair of tracksuit bottoms and start doing some power walking or go to the gym, heaven forbid?
I think the first 12 weeks of pregnancy are difficult. Obviously, there's the nausea, the tiredness. I mean, the commonest symptom in the first 3 months is extreme tiredness. So asking a woman to get up and go to a gym and do a lot of exercise is tricky. So normally, the time to do exercise, just walking, as you say, power walking, would be from about 12 weeks onwards. So the first 3 months, I think, is just get through it. And diet isn't always the best because women will often crave fatty foods, carbohydrates, just to avoid the sickness. So I normally say just take your multivitamins, get through the first 3 months, and then look to how you feel after 3 months.
And there's nothing, I mean, I remember very vividly going to Tesco's cafe and having a baked potato at 9:30 in the morning when about 8 weeks pregnant. I was looked at, but some real disdainful glances came my way. And at that point in your life, you are feeling very vulnerable and people don't know you're pregnant.
Correct.
So you do have special permission actually to behave any
absolutely.
Whatever the however the hell you like.
I read somewhere, because I was quite sick in the first 3 months, and I read somewhere that ginger, it was you could have a pack of ginger nuts by the side of your bed, and I must have eaten, I mean, I used to eat about 3 packets a day in the first, I was just scarfing
what, in the
them
vein
down.
Hope it would make you feel better.
Yeah. And also because they're just really nice.
Yes.
I wasn't keen on them, so that didn't, I mean, and the things you definitely don't go anywhere near are, well, blue cheese. I mean, is that still a thing? Because in France, they always eat blue cheese, don't they?
Well, even the French have accepted that the unpasteurised cheeses are not that safe. And it's because of this condition called listeriosis. And I think we try to avoid uncooked cheese, uncooked meats as well, and raw fish. But generally speaking, the uncooked foods are things to avoid.
And alcohol, no?
Again, The view is for women who've had difficulties in getting pregnant or have had miscarriages in the past, trying to minimise alcohol would be ideal. For most couples, a small amount of alcohol is not dangerous, but we normally say keep it to an absolute minimum, which may be half a glass a day at absolute maximum levels.
That's during the whole of pregnancy? Or
yes.
Just
yes,
the, okay. Yeah. And smoking, obvious no-no.
Avoid it because there's direct links to a reduction in the growth of the baby.
But if you have, and I'm sure this has happened to many women, certainly happened to me, if you had a bit of a night out only to discover you're pregnant 2 days later, is that a problem?
It's not in the slightest a problem, and it's very common to hear that story. So I wouldn't in any way be concerned or worried. I think it's very important to take the folic acid and multivitamins in that circumstance anyway. But apart from that, no, I wouldn't be worried.
And if you really can't do anything without a couple of lattes, what do you do?
I say one rather than two. So choose the time that you want that latte, and probably in the morning, first thing in the morning, and then just have one rather than two.
OK, well, I've already outed myself as going out for a baked potato at 9:30. Any other cravings, Lucy Port? Lucy Mangan?
I had cravings for crushed ice in the last bit of my pregnancy, which apparently is quite common and nobody knows why. But yes. God, if I could have such a craving again and be made so happy so easily and so calorie freely, I would be a happy woman.
Yeah, mine was ice lollies, so I was a bit more, I needed the sugar as well. But yes, citrus, my big thing with my second pregnancy, I was obsessed with citrus fruits, and I had a grapefruit bar of soap that I used to keep on my desk and sniff throughout the day. And I have no idea why that was so. And everyone said, oh, it means having a girl, and then I had a boy.
Oh, yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, old wives' tales are, they are rubbish.
People used to tell me stuff like that.
Although, I got terrible indigestion, and I was told I'd have hairy babies. Sure enough,
both had a full head of hair.
But if I could tell you that the majority of babies have hair on their head.
Oh, so, yeah, but not a full head of hair.
Okay,
like
fair, fair comment. No, I think that's...
Okay, and one had a hairbrush as well. It was fantastic. she hasn't used it since. What about vitamin supplements? There are special vitamin supplements you can buy in the... they presumably are not necessary, or are they not a bad thing?
Well, the vitamins that I think are important, the two major vitamins are vitamin D and folic acid. And folic acid is a B vitamin. And they're the two main ones that are important.
Do you get those on the NHS, or you have to pay for them?
I don't believe there are... prescribed on the NHS.
But equally, there are some vitamin supplements you should avoid during pregnancy.
Yes, so vitamin A would be the one to avoid in pregnancy.
And why is that?
That's associated with problems in the baby's development, and I think it's important not to take that if at all possible. So it's important to check your multivitamin supplement when you're actually taking...
What about if the mum... isn't well in pregnancy? Can a mum, I mean, I'm just talking, not something really dramatic, but just, I don't know, a throat infection or something.
Yes, and I think it's very important to see your GP when you do have a throat infection, because it's commonly due to a virus rather than a bacteria. But the GP will know what's common at that time of year. It's also important to determine whether they need antibiotics, because there are safe antibiotics in pregnancy.
Oh, you can take them?
You can indeed, but it needs to be checked with the GP.
And if you have a cold, is it okay to have one of those lemon drinks or a couple of paracetamol?
Yes, I think I normally say lemon and honey with some paracetamol is absolutely fine, and take lots of fluids as well.
Okay, but not Nurofen?
Definitely not Nurofen, definitely not Voltrol, any what we call non-steroidal medication.
Right, OK, got that. But paracetamol would be all right?
Paracetamol is fine, at the normal dose.
Yeah, sure, yeah. OK. Now, what about when you have your baby and babies do get, I mean, because they're very, very vulnerable, they get everything, or so it seems, in the first couple of months. When do you panic with a very small baby?
Well, I think it's very important to really understand your baby. So newborn babies, it's a completely new experience. But for first-time mums, it's very difficult to know what a baby's cry is. And so I think if a baby isn't feeding, if the baby is very lethargic, if the baby's got a high temperature, it's very important to get the advice of a healthcare professional, either GP, midwife, health visitor. It's very important. And if they just don't feel it's right, ask the question. It's better to seek reassurance than it is to leave it too long.
But babies do get ill a lot, don't they? I mean, not with serious things, fortunately, but with those everyday lurgies that, well, they've never had before, so they're going to get them.
Yes, but babies are, they become unwell very quickly, but they also get better very quickly as well. So I think if after 24 hours the baby's still unwell, seek the advice of a healthcare professional.
And there are medications suitable for very young babies?
There are some. I think they're paracetamol-based. They're the ones that are safe.
Yeah, if you've never bought Calpol before, you'll be buying it in bulk.
Absolutely.
For about 15 years. Lucy, did either of the Lucys have any scares with very little babies? And
I did with my first, with Emily. I did end up in A&E one night because her poo looked funny to me, which in hindsight you think, how ridiculous is that?
Oh, but it's not really, is it?
But no, and I mean, they are very... And the nice thing is, of course, like, the NHS is brilliant and they are incredibly reassuring and kind. And I think, I mean, in hindsight, I think what it was that I was just incredibly tired and stressed and losing my mind slightly, and the baby was actually fine, but at no point was I made to feel like I was being a hysterical, anxious mother. And then with a second baby, of course, we've you know, been very lucky. He's been very well, and also we've just worried a lot less, I think.
Every parent's big fear, and I don't want to be melodramatic, but it's a reality, is meningitis, Colin. So and this can strike both teenagers and people in their early 20s, and indeed very, very young babies, but they can't tell you how ill they're feeling, obviously. So there is a test you can do on the rash that they may or may not have, but they could have, with a glass. Just what do you do?
Yeah, so that's called the glass test, and you put it on the rash, on the skin, you take the glass off, and if the rash doesn't go away, then you call an ambulance.
OK, and it's 999 for a diabolical emergency, and 111 if you just want to ask a question.
If you want some advice, exactly.
Yeah, great. OK, thank you very much indeed, Colin. And thanks to Lucy Porter and to Lucy Mangan. You can find them both on Twitter. It's at Lucy Mangan, and very much less straightforwardly, at Luna Bimberton. I'm on Twitter too. It's at Jane Garvey. One. And Colin's website has got all kinds of help and advice on conception, fertility and birth, and that is at excellenceinwomenshealth.co.uk. Feel free to share this podcast on Facebook and anywhere else you like with your friends and your fellow parents-to-be. I'm Jane Garvey. Thank you very much for listening.
been listening to the My Baby and Me podcast in association with Nook. Visit us at nook.co.uk.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.